Okay, welcome. Our very first Awake in the Nest live gathering. Let me just pull up my windows here because I gotta make sure everything is available to be seen. I hope everyone is doing well. And for those of you who can be here in person, and Katie, I'm so happy that you're here in person. It's great. My expectation of this was that I might be teaching alone. And so it ended up being this really lovely experience to see you come in, because just, I know that we're all trying to figure out the schedules of everything. And as we do, I expect this will change. That's kind of how life is today. Mm-hmm. Life is always like that, but especially today. So I'm just going to explain really quickly what Awake in the Nest is, just because I've had a couple of people who are just brand new to the Nest, and I want to make sure that everyone's on the same page what we're doing here. So every month in the Nest, we have a theme, a monthly theme. And that theme guides all of the posts that I do on the Nest blog, and it also guides this particular meeting. So for instance, this month's theme is honesty, and I'm still rolling out the blogs. I think we've got one more next week that's going to come, but today's post talked about, for instance, honesty in bed. How do you get honest about what you really want in bed? And how does that relate to the way that you can be honest about what you want in the rest of your life? So that theme will carry us into this gathering. And the point of this gathering is to have a place for us to really try on those concepts that we're learning. This idea of honesty, for instance, we're going to try that on today. I like to always just make sure that we know this place is a safe space for exploration, which means that you are welcome to share as much as you want. You are welcome to hide as much as you want. It's, the safety is not dependent on me saying this is a safe space. It's dependent on you feeling safe enough to share or to hide, whatever your preference is. So there will be some points when I do ask people to share things. For those of you who do attend live, no one is obligated. It's absolutely up to you to make that call. If you feel it, if you don't feel it, do not do it ever, because I said so. And I'm not demanding that you do it. It's just simply a way, if you find that you gain benefit from being heard, being seen outside of your own mind, then please do share. But some people do and some people don't. And so that's part of being honest with yourself. What do you actually get the most out of? So that's my overview of the Nest. We think about this as a sandbox. This is a playful space. Actually, July's theme is going to be on playfulness, so we'll get a lot more into that. The first 3 months are the most important to me in terms of what I ground my practice in, what I ground my work in teaching: honesty, playfulness, and tradition. So those are the three. I've got three more after that, and I'm working on the next 6 month schedule. And I base these things on values. So values that we might have, values that we might need to dig a little bit deeper into, like honesty. We always begin with honesty. This is what I've heard almost every spiritual teacher say to me, that we begin with honesty, because when we're honest, we can get somewhere. If we're trying to cover things up, if we're trying to accommodate someone else's desires, we're never going to get anywhere. So honesty is what guides us today. And so what I want to do is start with, we're going to do a couple of practices today, but I want to do some understanding to ground us in the practices before we get into them. So we have, the first practice is going to ground us for the second practice, but before the first practice, we're going to ground ourselves into something else. And that grounding is going to be this word, it's a Sanskrit word, kanti. I'm by no means a scholar of Sanskrit, but I absolutely adore looking at the words. I love words in general, in any language. And so I adore looking at words in mantra, especially mantras that I have a specific relationship with, and unpacking the deeper meaning of those. So this word kanti, K-A-N-T-I, if anyone's interested, what it means is there is this idea that whatever we love becomes more beautiful. So that the Near direct translation is beauty that is enhanced by love. In other words, if we love something, it always becomes more beautiful. Because it's possible to love everything. And when we love even the ugly things, those two can become more beautiful. And when we love the most beautiful things about us, those also become more beautiful. Beauty, and this is not necessarily physical beauty. This is a sense of understanding beauty that is far beyond physical attractiveness. This is that way that, you know, when you fall in love with something, like I always think of this example. I live up in British Columbia, and so I have this wonderful privilege of being able to be surrounded by a lot of really tall trees. And I go into the woods and I am reminded of the fact that if these tall trees grew the way they grew in someone's yard, you would trim them, you would cut them back, you would call them ugly. But out in the wild, we look at those and we go, oh, that crooked tree is so perfect. We never question that. We never question that. This is Kanti. This is the idea of Kanti. So if we the opposite of it would be that we obsess about something and it becomes uglier. So we obsess about a tree in our yard and it becomes uglier because we're obsessed with it not being perfect. We have to cut that. We have to trim it. It reminds us of all the things we haven't done. So let the idea of Kanti really bring us today into this first exercise that we're going to do. So grab a journal, if you have one nearby, and a pen. And we're going to do the first exercise is going to be something that I am calling a party for everything that sucks. And what I mean by that is that in order to get to the place of having true gratitude, you know, there's this idea in spiritual, like kind of the neo-spiritual tradition of like, oh, you should have gratitude journals and you should have gratitude for things. Absolutely. But there are a few steps that you have to take before you can get to gratitude. Gratitude comes when the underlying feeling has been acknowledged. If you don't acknowledge that underlying feeling, what you're doing is you're bypassing the experience. And that experience is where the real juice is. So I'll give you an example. If you feel jealousy in a relationship and you suddenly have this feeling of like, well, what I really should do is have gratitude that I have a relationship, not feel jealous. I shouldn't feel jealous that my partner is attracted to someone else. What you're doing is you're just jumping right over that feeling of jealousy when the feeling of jealousy has so much to share with you. It tells you what you value. So with this party for everything that sucks, what we're going to do with this is in a few minutes, we're going to work in the journals and we're going to allow space for everything that sucks. But with a caveat, because it's really easy in these places to just spiral downward and to go into this place of like everything sucks and therefore everything sucks. And it just begins to feed on itself. So what we're going to do is we are going to add another term to everything that sucks, which is whatever it is, that feeling that I have, like I feel jealous and it makes me feel alive. And here's why we say that term. The nature of negative feelings is that we run. We want to run from them. We don't like them. We want to only feel the good feelings. We don't want to feel anything negative. And, you know, we don't like jealousy. We don't like greed. We don't like anger. We don't like feeling like a victim. So the idea is that if I just disappear, if I ignore these feelings, then I will be better. But we have them. And why do we have these? One of the reasons that we have these is because they show us that we're alive. They show us what we value. So I'll break that down. When we feel alive, What we're saying is that we are embodied. To be in a state, if you're a disembodied, in a disembodied state, if you're free from the body experience, what you are is you're either, a spirit, you don't have a body, you're just free flowing, free form consciousness out in the universe. You're just that kind of God stuff, that star stuff, or you are disassociating with your reality in the body. So that, I don't recommend the second one. It leads to all sorts of problems. When we disassociate, when we're in the body, we miss out on a lot of life. So to be embodied, when we feel most alive, you think about what are the times in which you feel most alive? You know, it's like these times when you're in the present moment. And just pause and think about that just for a moment. Think about times when you feel most alive. Maybe it's when you're in nature. Maybe it's when you're around a child. Laughter. Stillness. When do you feel most alive? Chances are you are far more connected to your body in those moments. You are feeling the senses. You're feeling your body. You're aware that your feet are touching the ground. You're aware of your body and the space it occupies. But the funny thing is when you feel most alive, you sometimes don't even realize it because you're just there. It's not a recognition of, oh, I feel very alive right now. It's the sense of, you know, you're having a really wonderful get together with some friends and family that you love and you want to be around. There's very little pausing to reflect on it in the moment. And that's what it means to be alive. So whatever we're experiencing though, we tend to disassociate when we have these hard feelings that come up. We tend to disembody ourselves when, let's say, we get angry. Because what happens is that we get angry and then immediately, for most people, especially for women, we come in with this belief, I shouldn't feel angry. I shouldn't feel angry. It's almost an automatic response, or I shouldn't feel this way because of XYZ. I have all that I should be grateful for. And what we're missing out on is the chance to be alive. So if you're just a spirit, you're just this free form consciousness, you're just playing in the realms of the cosmos, there's no such thing as emotion. This is the teaching. This is not something I've experienced in this body. Hopefully I've experienced it before this, but I've forgotten it. But there's this, it's the emotion is a body thing. Emotion is a human alive thing. What's taught is that when you're outside of the body is there's a sense of bliss that's like expansive and all pervading, and it's impossible to ignore it. And it's not like this momentary bliss of a piece of dark chocolate or an orgasm. It doesn't pass. It's just this bliss that you are just, you understand that you are one with the divine. And there's nowhere else to go. But having a body is quite different. You know, we have tremendous ups and downs in bodies. That's why yogis spend so much time trying to get out of this cycle. We don't want to get into the body again because it's hard. It's really hard work to sit here and go through the brutality of heartbreak. But there's also, you know, I personally, I love having a body. It's one of the things that I actually, there's something about this particular incarnation of me that is working on this. Like, I love having a body. I actually love the ups and downs. I don't love being in hard things in the moment. Nobody does. But what I love about it is the fact that you can break my heart and then you can mend it. And that's a really beautiful feeling. Because what we're doing there in that moment, every time one of us has our heart broken and every time one of us has it mended again or finds it that we have mended it ourselves, most likely. The free form consciousness, that part of us that is not associated with the body, it can grow. So when we, but let me just, I'm going to pause on that because that was a big statement. So the freeform consciousness, what's taught in, and I'm going to summarize a really complicated theory of existence here. So, but what's taught is basically there's freeform consciousness and then there's body experience. Freeform consciousness cannot know itself because it's simply just this bliss of the divine origin. So it has to come into physical manifestation in order to know itself, in order to have a mind, in order to have the senses. And this is Sankhya philosophy for anyone who's studied this kind of stuff, but it's an extremely high level view of that. But basically, without the body experience, without the negative and positive parts of having a human body and being alive, the greater freeform consciousness just simply can't grow. I really think this is what the scientists, the astrophysicists are saying when they say the universe is always expanding. I think it's because we're having more experiences. And these experiences are leading to more growth, and it's infinite. So what we're noticing when we have these so-called negative experiences, and they can be what it can also be what we're noticing when we're having the positive experiences. I don't like using those names, negative and positive, around emotion. We kind of lack another way of describing it, though. The ones that we don't like and the ones that we do like, perhaps. What we're experiencing when we have those feelings is we're experiencing the growth of the universe. That's it. So let's say I feel jealous. And you know, I chase the feeling away and I invalidate it. And I tell myself, I make a list on paper of all the things I shouldn't be jealous of, all the reasons I shouldn't be jealous and all the reasons that my jealousy isn't true. And all, you know, and if I'm jealous about my husband, let's say, he can come and assure me that all of the reasons that I have to be jealous are not valid. And at the same time, all of that logically could be true, but yet I still feel it. When I don't feel it, I don't get the opportunity to unpack what's really there. And instead, what I do is I cover it up. And anything that we cover up inside of us, any emotion that we invalidate and don't allow to be, what happens is it doesn't go away. It comes out warped and stronger. It comes out perverted. So if we simply said, if I were to feel jealous and I just simply said, I feel jealous and it makes me feel alive, then there is such honesty in that. It makes me feel alive. I'm not saying I'm right. I don't have to agree. I don't have to agree with my emotions. Logically, I can know I'm incorrect. Emotionally, I'm triggered. And likely with some validation of that emotion, which doesn't mean that it doesn't have to come from another person, this validation. It's really, really important to understand that this validation is from us to us. When we seek it from someone else, it's never going to fix it. It's never going to feel whole. But if we simply work with this understanding, I feel blank and it makes me feel alive. We don't have to agree with it, but we can be honest that they exist. So we're going to do an exercise here. And we'll start with just a very simple breathing and some locating. So you can pause wherever you are and just close your eyes. And we're going to focus the breath. The first thing that we're going to do is take our hands and just place them right at the base of our rib cage. So that's the place of the diaphragm. We're going to start there and then we're going to expand that location of the diaphragm into the pelvis. So first things first, just placing your hand on your diaphragm. You can have two hands, one hand, whatever works for you. And just breathing in. As you inhale, your hands will move outward, away from your spine. As you exhale, they'll move back toward your spine. So just noticing that first, breathing, feeling your hands pushing outward. As you exhale, your hands move inward. And there's a slightly different motion. You can keep on breathing like that. We'll expand this. As you inhale, the next time you inhale, notice how your diaphragm moves not only out, but also slightly down towards your pelvis. And if you have a reverse breathing pattern where you're typically, you've been untrained in this kind of breathing and you breathe into your chest, it's maybe harder to witness, but it is happening. Just takes practice. And so now we're going to shift the breath even lower. So you can keep your hands, you can move your hands back to any comfortable place and just begin to fill your whole belly into your pelvis, feeling as if the breath is moving into your pelvis, that the pelvis might actually be moving your breath, drawing it toward the pelvis. And then as you exhale, the pelvis releases, the diaphragm releases, the breath releases. Inhaling right down into your pelvis is drawing your breath down. As you exhale, your pelvis releases the breath, your diaphragm releases, your exhale releases. This is an embodied breath. This is a breath that typically makes us feel alive, makes us get into our lower part of our bodies, whereas most people, this is where most people dissociate first. So here, with this breath, in this safe space of your mind, knowing that this is only for you, locate a recent triggering experience. My suggestion is to do something minorly triggering. If you've had something majorly, we can work on it at a different time. Just locate it. And now name at least one emotion that you felt as a result of that triggering experience. Just give it a name. You may have more than one, which is fine. It's actually usual, it's typical. Now, if you can locate one emotion, you can do this for all of your emotions, but let's focus on just one. So locate one emotion that perhaps was the most central to this triggering event. And this will be a negative emotion, to be clear, one that you don't really want to feel. And now say to yourself, I felt blank, name that emotion, and it makes me feel alive. Say it again to yourself. I felt blank, name that emotion, and it makes me feel alive. One more time. I felt blank, name that emotion, and it makes me feel alive. And before you open your eyes, Take another one of these deep pelvis breaths in. So just feeling the breath, feeling the pelvis pulling, you're drawing your breath down to fill this space in your body. Allow the breath to affirm the weight of your body on the earth, to affirm your aliveness. Notice the shift from when you first located that triggering event and now. It might be subtle. It might be dramatic, depending on how you felt with this experience, with this particular form of affirmation. It will have different effects. But just be aware of them. And open your eyes when you're ready. Katie, how was that for you? If you want to share, always optional.
It was interesting because I'm sure, you know, at one point I was like, am I doing this right? But as soon as you said this will be a negative emotion, I was like, yeah, okay, it is. And the combination of pairing it with the feeling of alive almost seemed contradictory at first. Because I'm feeling this negative emotion, yet it's making me feel alive. And I guess I associate alive with, has a more of a positive connotation. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, wait, just focus back on what I'm doing. But I was like, well, you know, there's so many examples of people having so much anger and just feeling alive. So I think it's very possible to feel alive in the context of both a positive or negative emotion, or an emotion you enjoy, you like, and an emotion you don't like.
Yeah, yeah.
That was just an interesting thing to note.
Isn't that amazing how much can happen when you're just in your own mind for a minute? Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. It's like you just basically unraveled the history of your life in what, 3 minutes?
You know, yeah.
This is why meditation is challenging for people, because it's forcing us to go deep into going, oh my God, those are tendencies that I have that were, I was unaware of those before. You know, for you, the tendency in this case was that you associate being alive with something that you enjoy. But there is, have you ever had a time when you're in a really, really dark space where you felt alive? You don't have to share necessarily the darkness, but just if you've ever had that experience.
Sure. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, what comes to mind, not just with me, but it's like those stories you hear of people hitting rock bottom is usually they say, mm-hmm. and like they, it's just a matter of not being able to tolerate it anymore. And there's such vigor, there's such life in that somewhere in their mind and body that they're motivated enough to make a change.
Right.
So I think for me, yes, I've felt that. But it's not always clear the best way to act to make a change.
Right, right, right.
For what I want.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Yeah. I'll share an experience that I shared this on, for Angela. I know Angela will listen, but I shared this on her podcast. I was on her podcast a few, months ago at this point. And I shared this story that I also shared during my last fall's body story class, where I had thrown my back out and I was sitting here, it was in this room and I was wailing. Just like, it was the worst pain I'd ever experienced. It was like childbirth. It was like that level of pain. And it was in the middle of the fall. And I have this beautiful maple tree out front of my house. And I'm sitting here like wailing and like screaming in pain. Cause I don't tend to keep Advil around my house. I just didn't have any, and we've been moving so much. And so, you know, all of the stuff that I would normally use for pain, I didn't have. So anyway, I'm in the middle of all this, experiencing incredible pain. And I look outside my window and I see this maple tree, and it's the middle of autumn. And this thing is bright with golden leaves. I still like that the image of these leaves, golden and this like bright, vibrant red on each of the leaves. And I had this moment of feeling alive in the midst of incredible pain, in the midst of like, it was Sunday. I'm like, am I dying? I can't even get to a doctor. Yet there's this moment of embodiment. So it is possible. And I share that experience because it's something that we don't oftentimes think that that's a possibility. But I guarantee that if everybody went back into the darkest points in their lives, like that rock bottom point that you pointed out, Katie, and there is a place where we feel alive. And that's honesty. Feeling alive is honesty. There's nothing else but that. Honesty is saying, I feel these really horrible feelings sometimes. I am wrong. My feelings are incorrect. They are not logically correct all the time. Sometimes they might be guided by intuition, but not always. Sometimes they're just frankly wrong. Like I got angry about something and I was wrong about it because I misperceived it. It happens all the time, but I can still recognize that I feel alive because of that. So we'll move into the second exercise. And as I mentioned, the idea of Kunti, okay? Kunti brings us to that place of feeling alive. So when we are able to sit in those ugly places and find something that we can give our love to, like me and that maple tree, then we understand how something that is ugly can become beautiful. So Kunti led us to that first exercise. The first exercise leads us to this new one, this second one. Because I find that as I was mentioning before about this idea of gratitude, that it's really difficult to go to the place that I'm going to have you go today if you haven't done what you just did. Because what happens is that when we go to this place, if I were to say to you just right out of the gate, we're going to do this exercise, I'm not giving it away yet, but I was going to say to you, we're going to do this. What would happen is that you would come up with doubts. You would be met with doubts. You'd say, well, but I'm not good enough. I have all these other things that are bad, you know, bad in quotes. And I want to make sure that the doubts, they have their place. They have their, I think either December or January is going to be fully focused on this idea of confusion as a sacred feeling, as a sacred experience of being absolutely confused, because it's something that we all go through. And my point in this is that we're going to go deeper into it, I promise you. But right now, what I can say is that the doubts create confusion. And that in confusion, there's tremendous opportunity. So June's theme is honest and or honesty. And what we're going to do here is get honest. And so what I'm going to ask you to do is a sort of confessional, but not in the way that you might be used to, especially if you're raised in any kind of a Catholic understanding of what confession is. This is not about going and telling people how much of a sinner you are. We're actually going to do the opposite. We're going to confess things that we're really good at. This is the exercise. And this is why I say you couldn't get there until you say, I feel terrible about myself in this way, and it makes me feel alive. Because it just takes away all of that shadowy doubt that comes in that says, well, I shouldn't shine. I shouldn't be honest about the fact that I have certain aptitudes that others don't have. It doesn't make us better. We are just simply expressing a different form of the manifestation. That's it. Why would we hide that? I don't know. Well, you know, I think I do know. It's a lot of social conditioning. It's a lot of social conditioning. We are actually in a society where women are oftentimes diminishing their success. And if you were to ask someone, so there's this dress designer, and I'm always messing it up, if it was Donna Karan or who's the one who did the wrap dresses? At any rate, there's a famous dress designer. We'll just say it like that. And, you know, she's got this interview where she says that she wakes up every morning and feels like a failure. Because this is what all of us feel. It doesn't matter how successful a woman is. She's going to feel like a failure. She's going to feel that she has failed. And one of the things that I think feeds on this, there's many things that feed on this. There's many things that contribute to it. But one of the things that happens is that there are very few examples of women who are willing to say, hey, I'm really good at this. I really celebrate this about myself. Without it feeling like it has to come with a diminishing. So for instance, you know, somebody compliments you. Oh my gosh, I love your dress. And your response is, I got this so long ago. This thing is like $10 at a thrift store. And it was like, it's all ripped. You see this, you know, and like, rather than just sitting with the fact that you could say, you know what, I really have a good sense of style and I know how to find a good bargain. We go to the place to cut ourselves down. We try to cut ourselves down so that we can appear relatable. You know, it's got a little bit different for different people, depending on this, but oftentimes what it is a sense of like, don't stand out. We're here to stand out. We're here to be honest about what we really are meant to do. Because if we don't own the things that we're really good at, you know, we never really get to follow through with what we're here to do. So I want to say one thing about attention, because this is a very important teaching. Women's, I'm going to say this, it's like, this is my caveat for any time I talk about feminine and masculine energy. We all have all of these. Everybody has feminine and masculine energy. And some people express it in different ways. That's it. That's like, if we are all confused about gender identity, let's just take it from the understanding of that. These expressions will change all the time based on parts of our life that we're in, based on experiences that we're having in the moment. They will change. So we'll talk about feminine energy and masculine energy, not men and women. So the feminine energy has a natural inward gaze. This is, if you think about it, a state of surrender that a lot of spiritual traditions teach. So in a state when you were breathing a few moments ago, you're in a state of surrender. You're in a state of peace. You were inward gazing. This is the natural feminine primordial direction, inward. And this is true if a man embodies his feminine energy and a man is a meditator and he ends up with a lot of inward gazing, he will have a little bit more of a feminine energy expression than a man who is doing what masculine energy does, which is looking outward. So this has to do with our ability to say the things to name the things that we're really good at because of this. When a woman is in a healthy state, this inward gaze can look like receiving. It can look like being really in touch with what we're feeling and being willing to say it. But if it's in an unhealthy state, the inward gaze becomes really threatening. It feels powerless. It feels sometimes like there's like no boundaries on our space. And it feels sometimes because of the fact that girls and women have been conditioned to have more of this. So it's basically like we have this natural state because we're women, we have a little bit more feminine energy. And then we've been conditioned we've been validated the more that we continue to like consciously be aware of the way that we appear physically and what that says about our being. What happens is that whenever we are then gazed at, whenever we are in the spotlight, it feels really threatening. It feels like someone is coming to get us. If you've ever had someone give you a compliment and had this feeling of like, you just want to squirm out of your body, or ever had an invitation to speak in front of a crowd and all eyes are on you in that moment, all eyes are on you, and suddenly you become aware of something. You're like, oh, this blouse is not fitting me. My hair, I didn't do it correctly today. My earrings are doing this. You know, you become much more aware of yourself. And then the power of the message that you're trying to deliver becomes really disrupted by all of that inward focus. So this is why I'm saying that we oftentimes will then avoid drawing attention to ourselves as a form of protection. Think about this from a sexual point of view as well. So as girls, this happened to me. I mean, this happened to me when I was like 14. It happened to me today. It's like, this happens. You're walking down the street and there's this gaze, right? There's like somebody who looks at you. Usually it's a man. You know, I remember being 14 years old and walking down the street and feeling that feeling of like, this man, like somebody who's my father's age, driving by and gazing. And it felt very invasive. And my friends and I would actually joke about it. We didn't know what to do with it because it just felt icky. It just felt wrong. We felt like we were pinned down like one of those bugs on the little trays, the way that they examine them. That's how it felt. And so, yeah, it makes perfect sense that we're going to do everything we can to either avoid drawing attention to ourselves or begin to, this is the other unhealthy expression, is to draw attention to ourselves in a way that continuously affirms something that we believe about ourselves. There is a third way. There's always a third way, which is to, you can begin to really own the gaze. So that's a different teaching. But what I'll say about this is that what we're going to do here, well, actually, no, that is part of this teaching. I'll backtrack on that because there's a deeper way that we can go into it, but this is very much relevant. To own what you're good at, is a way to really shift that gaze from being something that someone projects onto us to being something that we say, I'm going to claim this thing. And I'm going to then take that gaze that is inward. I'm going to use it to draw out the treasure chest of stuff within me and then share that from my heart. So this doesn't, you know, people get uncomfortable because we're taught not to brag. We're taught not to say all these things and we're taught to be humble. And it's just a real challenge. When it comes, like, I believe all this. I am a huge believer in humility. Humility in the face of your deity of choice, for instance. Very important. But that humility isn't saying I am lesser than you. The humility that is really necessary is it's an awe of the greatness, in awe, and not of the greatness of a single individual being, but in awe of the expansive freeform consciousness that being might be connected to, that I am also connected to. This is why when we fall in love, we find ourselves in awe of another person. Because suddenly this other person is reminding us that we're limitless. And so we can fall in love with ourselves in this same way. By seeing ourselves as naming these things and saying, these are honest reflections of the gifts that I came in with or the gifts that I have cultivated over the course of my life. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to practice feeling safe being seen because that is the key thing, it's the key difference with having power. Okay, so if you can feel comfortable being seen without it feeling like you're that bug pinned down, then you can really own your power and you can know how to direct it outward, use that masculine gaze outward, or to have that more surrendered inward gaze. And today we're going to practice this by celebrating ourselves. Okay, I'm going to set a timer for 3 minutes. We're going to do some journaling here. And your job in these 3 minutes is to make a list of all the ways that all the things that you're good at, all the ways that you shine. And these can be really small things. These can be like, you know, I'm really good at remembering to drink water all day at different points in the day. Or it can be like really big things. Like I am super good in a crisis under pressure. So I'm going to set my timer and we're just going to write. And if you get stuck, just write, I am stuck and it makes me feel alive. So just make a basic list. Doesn't have to be pretty. Okay, about 30 seconds. And finish up that thought. Okay. How was that?
It was good. I've done these kinds of writing exercises in the past, so familiar, I guess, for me. I don't feel like I really struggled to come up with a list. Maybe at the end, I was like, But then I almost got to the point of putting more of a judgment to it, being like, well, am I good at that or am I not? You know, and just starting to second guess myself.
Second guess yourself, yeah. Mm-hmm. Were you more specific or were they more general?
A little bit of both, but I guess probably more on the general side.
Mm-hmm. Great. That was my suspicion. And I suspect that anyone who's going to be watching the video will also be on the more general side in this first part, which is fine. Because what we're going to do next is we're going to go deeper into more specificity. Because if you think about it, like, have you ever had a compliment where someone's like, oh, that was such a great job? And it's meaningless. But if you have a compliment where somebody says, I loved the way that, let's say this is a work situation, I loved the way that you owned that process from beginning to end. And then that time that there was a problem, you were right there stepping up to deal with it and found a solution that made everybody's lives a lot easier. It lands so much more when you have that. So we have to do the same thing. And this is feedback for, you know, that you're giving to other people. You know, you're always taught like find these specific things. And it makes a lot of sense because if you tell someone, oh, thanks, you don't really get that much. But if you say to somebody, I really appreciate you taking the garbage out today. There's a lot more like a win. There's a win there. And that's what we're going for. We're allowing ourselves the chance to win. Because I remember this exercise that we used to do when I was working in the nonprofit corporate world, that we would always, after an event happened, we would always go back and debrief it. And we'd have these like four categories of things. And it was always this thing of one of the categories was what we did wrong. And that was always the one that had the most stuff listed in it. Even if it was like an event that was super successful and it was really well done, it was so much harder for us to find the things specifically that we did right as opposed to what we did wrong. The minutia was in the other category, but it was these overarching, like it went well, X number of people showed up. We earned, you know, we fundraised this amount of money, as opposed to the speaker didn't work and this person was late and they need to make sure that next time that person is like brought by hand to the venue. So much easier to do that. So, you know, what we're going to do is going to do another round where we're going to pick a handful of things. It doesn't have to be everything on your list, but let's say we're going to pick three things. At most, you might even just spend your time on one of these things that you're really good at. Get specific. So for instance, one of the things that I always say, I'm a really good writer. It's something that from my childhood, I have been a really good writer my whole life. If I were to deny that about myself, I would be lying. But for me to say I'm a really good writer is not enough. It's like, why am I a good writer? Okay, I understand the nuance of word. Of using one word over another. I understand I have a strong value in making writing very accessible. So not writing in, you know, I have a massive vocabulary, but I don't use it. I write in these accessible ways. And I also, I write in ways that people will get something out of it. So even when I'm writing fiction, it's not just like, you know, a bodice ripper. You know, I'm writing deep stories. So you see, I'm getting a little bit more, and you see, it was actually hard to come up with that specificity. But the more that we praise ourselves in that way and give ourselves that kind of acknowledgement of, okay, you're good at this, you're a good cook. Okay, what makes you a good cook? What about your style of cooking do you really, really excel at? Why do you excel? And that doesn't mean that someone else's style is worse. You know, it just is different. Someone else is also a really good writer because they might use really eloquent words. They might write over someone's head, like, you know, good Lord, if you have, if you talk about readability, like I have read a lot of the Russian authors and the readability factor is not present. I mean, it took me 2 years to get through Crime and Punishment. 2 years, because I sat there because it's such a dense text. But he's a really good writer. It's a really fantastic story. But my style of writing, like what I am good at, doesn't mean that Dostoevsky is not also good at. at writing, okay? We're both good at writing. We just are good in different ways. So it allows space for everyone's experience. So we're gonna pick 1 to 3 things on your list that are a little bit more general, and we're going to color them in. So we will do another 3 minutes on that. So I'll set the timer and start writing. And again, if you get stuck, just write, I am stuck, and it makes me feel alive. It was 40 seconds a few seconds ago. Okay, just finish up your last thought. How was that one?
Okay, that was good. I also love to write, and I know that's not the same thing as being a good writer, but I love to write. So I found when you said, oh, choose 1 to 3 things and we'll write for 3 minutes, I'm like, I could write for 15 minutes on just one thing. Like, how am I gonna choose one? And like, as soon as it came down to the second of when you were like, all right, the time is starting, I was back and forth in my mind, like, which one should I choose? So I just like let it come out as from my pen as I was writing, and found that as I was detailing why I was good at that one thing, I actually incorporated some of the other things from the first list that were more general, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I felt like that could have been the case for a number of the points had I chosen. You know, so like I only chose and wrote about one, but if I had chosen a different one, I think I would have seen overlap. Like the reason I'm good at this one thing is because of these other things that are already in my list, or somehow there's a connection there.
Yeah. Because you're united being. And yeah, so would you share an example of like what's one of those threads?
Sure. So the point I wrote on was that I'm good at being resourceful. Uh-huh. Okay, which is pretty general because you can be resourceful in many things in life. So then one of the things that from my first list, again, that I felt like supported that reason for me being resourceful was being frugal, for example. So just being able to really keep, actually, I want to go back. The first thing I wrote about, which was also the first point on my list, is that being organized mm-hmm. in like physical and electronic spaces. So I feel like I'm resourceful because I am good at keeping track of things. And by things, I know it's really general, but it really like encompasses so many things. So if I know where something is or how to access it or who that person is, then I can rely on that as a resource for me because of my organizational skills. Mm-hmm. And also my being frugal, I feel like allows me to be resourceful. Like I can work with what I have. Whether that is actual money or substances and like bringing in like a improvisational skill to mm-hmm. it as well. Being like, I'm going to just work with what I have. And to me, that's a sign of being able to be resourceful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Cause it's like what it does is it paints this picture of you where you are both organized and improvisational, which seemingly would be in opposition, but in actuality, the way that they manifest in you is not that way. The way they manifest in you is that you are organized enough that you can improvise mm-hmm. and you can kind of use whatever you've got. So if you've, you know, if you're going to cook some food and you've got like, you know, a cabbage, a carrot and some rice, you could probably figure out something really good to do with that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, yeah. So your benefit, like your particular skill that you bring to the world has to do with your understanding of containers. So, because when you are organized, you understand how to make a container. That's all organization is. It's like, I know how to contain this. People who struggle with organization typically have difficulty with containers. Things spill out everywhere when they really should be tight, or things are allowed to be or made to be too tight when they should really just spill out a little bit more. And so what you're recognizing is like your value is so much about containers. You're like, I have great understanding of containers. I know what fits in what bucket. And therefore I can improvise once I'm in that. And you see how much different that is than just being like, I'm very organized. It's more rich. And so then, you know, this is what we have to do when, because we all have these low times, right? We all have these times when we're feeling like the shittiest we could possibly feel. And in those moments, if we can draw upon something like this, and look at ourselves in the mirror or just in our mind's eye and just say, wow, look at me, even in my lowest point, like me and the maple tree outside my window, even in my lowest point, I still seek beauty. I still seek beauty and I still find beauty and I still find love. And then therefore the ugly things become more beautiful. This is the trick to getting out of those headspaces, that spiral that we go into where we just say, everything about me sucks. You just pull upon one very specific thing that you can say about yourself, that even if it's just, this sucks and it makes me feel alive. Getting honest with where you are, not just about the bad things, but about the good things too, is truly, truly transformational. So what I'll invite us all to do is doing a little bit of emotional digestion at the end of this, at the end of all of these gatherings. We'll do a little bit of this emotional digestion, which is what we'll call a frame. This is actually a container, Katie. You'll be very good at this. So when we close, what we can do is you can either share it or you can write it down in your notebook. What are you going to take away from this experience? Just pause with that, be with that thought. And the more that we allow ourselves to have those moments of just a quick second of emotional digestion, just to say, hey, this is what I took away from that. And you do this every time you listen to a podcast or read a book, and then suddenly your retention will go up because it's the application that matters. You know, what do we remember in school? It has nothing to do with what we got our test on. It has to do with what we will really use and what draws our attention. Even if we don't really understand it at the moment, what draws our attention is what we will really use. So thank you so much. Thank you, Katie, for being here in person. It was lovely to have this private audience with you. And thank you to everyone who's watching this on at a later point in time. I really appreciate everyone for being part of the Nest. I am so, so, so excited to have this program going. And I cannot wait until I see you next time. And I see you either in our one-to-one sessions or in the next gathering, which will be on the third Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock Pacific. And always, 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 I will record it and send it out for those of you who can't make it at that time. All right, so be well, and I'll talk to you all soon. Bye. Bye, Katie.
I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you.